I'm Simon Locke, Vice President of the Foreign Press Association and the Ian Williams. Ian is the President of the Foreign Press Association. Ian, Amnesty International's new report on Ukraine has really kind of blown up in a literal type of a way. What's your perspective?
Well, it's almost like deja vu all over again. If you remember, a few weeks ago, we were talking about the Associated Press report, which was in the same terms, complete lack of perspective and balance. It picked up on one incident and blew it up, knowing full well the troll factories in the Kremlin would jump on it and distort it. And Amnesty has fallen into the same trap. I can't help but suspect they might be using the same sources. And just for the benefit of listeners, if you remember, they produced a report and said that the headline of which, the whole gist of, was that the Ukrainian armed forces were putting civilians at risk. Now, to many people, this seemed anomalous, not least since it was, in fact, 500,000 Russian soldiers pouring shells on the heads that put people at risk. But, you know, we're allowed to be even-handed. So they're saying that the Ukrainians were stationing their weapons in civilian areas and therefore violating the rules of war. There are two points on this. One is, it's actually not against the rules of war to put weapons in civilian areas to defend them, which is why you saw pictures in London during the Blitz of anti-aircraft establishments in Buckingham Palace, right at the center. It wasn't because they were consciously endangering their majesties. It was they defending them. And this, once again, it lost the whole perspective, which was that Russians had invaded Ukraine. They were killing civilians. They were invading cities. They were pounding cities. They were pulverizing them. When they got into them, they killed people. So what were the Ukrainians supposed to do? Were they supposed to lay down a red carpet and say, please, please, pretty please come in. We don't want to risk any violence here. You just come in, rape and loot and pillage the way you've been doing all along. I don't think the Ukrainian civilians would have had much to say for the Ukrainian army if they did that. But, you know, allowing there might well be excesses where the Ukrainians have taken some risks. But then you look at the report, and the report itself did not substantiate what they were saying. One of their prime witnesses was an old lady whose son was killed by the Russians in the course of all of this. He was going to feed. She had been feeding the Ukrainian soldiers in the next building because she saw the Ukrainian soldiers as defending her. If the Ukrainian soldiers had run away, then they would have been desertion. They would have been callous indifference to the potential damage the Russians had caused. And yet again, if they had forced the civilians to leave at Bayonet Point, that's against the rules of war. They had encouraged. The Ukrainians are still encouraging and trying to get people out of Kherson and other potential war zones. And as far as we can tell, the Russians are keeping them there. So this is the background to this. So yes, Amnesty International has a point. And Amnesty International should, in fact, hold both sides to account because they're not on one side or the other, just as we as journalists shouldn't be. We're not pro-Russian or pro-Ukrainian. We're pro-human rights and we're pro the truth, which is one of the reasons why so indignant about this. The sort of fallout from this was substantial. I suspect there was a quasi-apology. In fact, there were two quasi-apologies. One was not an apology at all, but Agnes Gallimard, the head of Amnesty International, basically said everyone who criticized them was a Russian troll.
So that makes us trolls.
Well, yes, and you know my opinion about the Russians on this. So, yes, very interesting. Ukrainian trolls, of course. It was even-handed, we thought, but Agnes Gallimard made it worse because she basically dismissed vituperatively any criticism. In the meantime, I've spoken to former Amnesty officials. I've spoken to people who work for Amnesty now, all of whom are, for various reasons, don't want their names mentioned. But they all say this report was awful. It's caused huge damage in Amnesty. One of the reasons, I'm sure, is all over the continent, all over Europe, all over America, people are cancelling their checks and standing orders to Amnesty. And it's not a fly-by-night response. It's not. It is a legitimate response to a complete lack of proportion on the part of Amnesty. Because their final apology didn't say, oh, I've put the wrong emphasis on the report, which would have been legitimate. They actually basically said, we're sorry some people took it badly. So we're sorry we hurt your feelings by accusing your defenders of being complicit in war crimes, whether they were or not. It's really piles on more and more. So Amnesty's dug itself deeper into a grave, and I really can't see that it can get out of it without firing Agnès Gallimard. Whether they do or not, NGOs are mysterious creatures. They're oligarchies in their own right, and the people who run them are oligarchs. So she might well hang on, but it would be a grievous cost to the organization, which incidentally has been controversial in the past as well. They did say that Navalny, the Russian oligarch, wasn't a prisoner of conscience at one point. And in my remote past, I actually took them to task many, many years ago because they decided that Mordecai Vanunu, who released word of Israel's nuclear weapons, was not a prisoner of conscience. And in that case, it was very particularly donor-driven. They thought they would lose pro-Israeli donors if they made him a prisoner of conscience, so they refused to do so. So for many years, they just held him as a person who was suffering harsh conditions of punishment. He's still in Israel. He's not allowed to leave after 40 years, which is when I first dealt with him and took up his case and spoke to his brother in London. I mean, but Amnesty got away with that one because eventually they came clean and did the right thing. Coming clean now is going to be too right. It's quite true they have lambasted the Russians for their war crimes. They have listed and detailed the Russian war crimes, which makes it even more culpable that they take a report on one small aspect of Ukrainian behavior, and instead of putting it as a caution, they knew what the Kremlin would do with this. They ran it as Ukrainian culpability for civilian deaths. And, you know, this is, it's an outrage against common sense. Like I said, Russians attacked cities. Cities contain civilians. Ukrainians defend the civilians. They do it in the cities instead of banning them. So what's wrong with this equation? Only the drafters of this report from Amnesty can see it. Everybody else can see it. But Amnesty is obviously not in a self-corrective mode. And you know, it reminds me to some extent of either it was culpable because they felt, I feel, you know, you often see this in journalism. It's an either or thing, and we have to balance and we have to have both sides. As we've said before, if we do a press conference on the space launch, then we don't get someone from the Flat Earth Society to comment. We did not, when we had a thing on the Second Amendment a few weeks ago, get somebody from the NRA to comment on it. That type of spurious balance does actually work with people. And in this case, I think maybe Amnesty International, oh, we've been giving the poor Russians a hard time. And I hate to say it, but many, 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 many human rights activists in the West are, like myself, I have to say, I'm culpable here, of a leftist disposition. And we've tended to give slack to the Russians and the Chinese and others over the years because they've had so much stick thrown at them by an America whose hands are far from clean. But on this occasion, I think somebody has gone overboard to balance the books. And it just looks ridiculous. They had no concept of how it appeared to the public or the fact that Russian embassies and consulates all over the world were rebroadcasting the report. Not the bits about the Russians, by the way. Just the bits about the Ukrainians. So look at the report. Factually, it's there's not much in it that you could disagree with. It's the emphasis, the targeting, the headlining. Amnesty needs new writers. It needs people who have some sense of perspective, because the ones they've got now obviously don't.
You know, there's no doubt that it does seem extraordinarily tone deaf. I think you just made the point that, you know, it may not be factually inaccurate, but it's kind of missing the context. You know, what are the takeaways for journalists? Because this generated a lot of coverage. And on the first day, you know, you tend to get straight coverage of what Amnesty reported about the Amnesty report. And then subsequently, we're getting a lot of attention to the Ukrainian response and everything else. What do you think is the takeaway for journalists when journalists read this particular report? You know, what should be the response? What should they be thinking about?
They should read the report. A lot. And took their tone from that. Just like the AP report before, which took out one paragraph from the UN report, highlighted that in a similar vein as Ukrainian culpability and blasted it. And, you know, it's a sense of proportion. The fact that journalists should weigh things carefully. You shouldn't take anything that anyone says, whether it's the Ukrainian government or Amnesty International, as written gospel. You should check it out. You should read the report carefully. And if it smells, and this did smell, you should say, hey, hang on, let's try and get another view on this. What did the Ukrainians say? And not just because the Ukrainians are a party in there. The Ukrainian branch of Amnesty International has disowned the report and is refusing to reproduce it inside Ukraine. The head of it has resigned as a result. Now, there are reasons why an international organization like Amnesty might want to discount its local people. But on this occasion, I mean, it's not as though Ukraine might have its many faults, but it's not a police state. Amnesty in Ukraine is quite happy and able to castigate the government when it thinks it's done something wrong. There are dissidents in Ukraine who don't get bonked on the head and taken off or hit with poison right away, unlike across the border. So, you know, as things go, it's a relatively free society. So they should have listened to what the local people told them. So altogether, you know, sometimes it looks so convoluted, you almost believe it's a conspiracy. The fact that the report that says the Russians overall details horrendous Russian crimes ends up being headlined as Ukrainian crimes. The fact that this is broadcast across the world. The fact that Amnesty International in Ukraine disowns it. The fact that instead of apologizing or saying, well, maybe we should have put a different emphasis or spin on it, digging in and basically giving the finger to the critics. And then, you know, finally, an apology that's not an apology. Oh, we're really sorry. How could you possibly be offended at something like this? We're sorry if that happened. That's a classic non-apology. And just in strict PR terms, from Amnesty International's point of view, if somebody in Amnesty International wanted to make sure they never got another check from people like me, that all of our standing orders are cancelled, that's the way to go about it. Well done, Amnesty International PR team.
Well, Ian, thanks very much indeed for your perspective. I think that encapsulates the issue really well. It's extraordinary, actually, that it almost the takeaway feels like, and I've seen this actually from the Russian side, which is basically just withdraw, don't fight, you know, to get yourself out of the cities, and then there won't actually be any issues, except for the fact that that is the path for Russia to have completed its invasion of Ukraine, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, the message that other people are sending, the larger message, is that it's people should not defend cities. You should hand them over to the Russians. They're making it so that the Russians now have an excuse to bomb cities. There were troops in there. Like I said, there were anti-aircraft establishments in Buckingham Palace during the Blitz. And the famous sign at the Liverpool Football Club match was the Germans bombed our chippy. Because the family's chip shop was blown up during the war and they took it badly even 50 years later. So, you know, it's this type of attitude is not good, and it should have been obvious. So there's another one I really want to throw in. April Glaspie was the American charge d'affaires in Baghdad in the dying days of Saddam Hussein's regime before the First Gulf War. And when she was approached by Saddam Hussein, who asked what the attitude was to the border dispute with Kuwait, she basically was under orders from James Baker and the State Department and the White House to say, we don't have a dog in this fight. That's between you and Kuwait. Now, that is the type of cloth-earedness we're seeing here. Anyone who knows what they're dealing with Saddam Hussein, Vladimir Putin, knows that when you come out with an equivocal statement like that, these people don't do nuance. They take it as a go fetch. It's a culpable lack of judgment and balance.
Ian, thanks very much indeed.